Cattle can't seem to get a break in the media. In fact, if the polar bear has come to symbolize the most widely recognized four-legged victim of climate change, the cow has come to represent the polar opposite. Our bovine buddy has become the climate villain in the eyes of the public, a cause of climate change that's up there with driving your car or burning fossil fuels. This demonization of cattle, whether you view it that way or not, might not be entirely fair to our ruminant friends, according to U.S.-based writer, environmental lawyer, and rancher Nicolette Han Nieman.
My whole thesis, probably several of you at least have read my book, Defending Beef, is that this is an issue that has become just sort of radically oversimplified. And we're told over and over again that cows, cattle, are bad for the climate. It's always cows in the mainstream media, so I'm using that phrase. But cattle are bad for the environment in general, and now specifically they're bad for the climate. And therefore, everybody should eat less beef, and farmers should be getting away from raising cattle.
Nieman is probably one of the most vocal proponents of sustainable meat in North America. She's published two books. One's got a really great name. It's called The Righteous Pork Chop. I really recommend it. And her articles have also been published in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The LA Times as well. The weird part about all this is that Nieman's actually a vegetarian.
Every single person in agriculture, we're really kind of on the front lines of the opportunity to do something very, very positive in this arena, and that each of us can improve. And I absolutely include myself and our ranch in that. In fact, I'm having an almost daily conversation with my husband about this because he's a little bit more he's the one who's been there for the whole time that our ranch has existed, and he's kind of set up all the systems that are there, and I'm kind of the innovator coming in and wanting to do this and do that, and he's kind of the, wait a minute, slow down, you know. So we're kind of having these constant discussions around our dinner table about what we can do on our own ranch. So I'm not just talking at you, I'm actually talking about all of us and what we can do to do things better, and I think it's urgent that we do things better, all of us.
In this episode of Rural Roots to Climate Solutions, we're going to unpack Nieman's argument that there is a place for cattle in a world trying its best to take action on climate change, and that maybe, just maybe, this common assumption that we need to ditch meat for the survival of the planet warrants at least a second look. It's like Nieman says, it's not the cow, it's the how. She actually has a t-shirt with that printed on it, I've seen it. My name's Derek Leahy, and I'm talking to you from the heart of cattle country in central Alberta.
I got to be part of the Nobel Prize ceremony and the celebrations in 2016, and I realized it kind of upped my sense of urgency about this conversation, because I realized that all of these really smart people that were there, the dialogue was on food that they did this year associated with the Nobel Prizes, and they had a full day discussion about the issue of food right before the Nobel Prize ceremony the next day, and they had 23 people from around the world. Seven of them were former Nobel laureates. And they were in dialogue with experts about the topic, so it was food. So I was the meat person, and I was the pro-meat person. And sort of everybody else on the program was kind of anti-meat. And all the Nobel laureates who know almost nothing about farming or food or agriculture kind of said, well, we all know that, you know, we should be eating less meat, and then, you know, we can move on. And I was really kind of alarmed by it, because I realized, like, wow, these are the smartest people in the world, and they don't really know that much about this topic, but this is what they assume is common knowledge, everybody knows this. And that's when I realized I really had to sort of be a little more explicit about especially addressing that eat less meat message.
That's Nieman speaking at the Organic Alberta Conference earlier this year in Red Deer. So what we've done here is we've taken the audio from her presentation, chopped it up into the more relevant bits, and threw it together to create this podcast episode, along with a bit of narration from me. Nicolette began her presentation that day discussing the greenhouse gas emissions that are produced by agriculture.
So I do think it's important that agriculture be part of the climate discussion. But you see, it's really not, it's a relatively small piece. And what really jumped out at me was the stability of it. It's almost the same the whole time on the graph. And to get a little, whereas you see some of the other sectors are really increasing. So to get a little more specific, this is from the text of the report. The increase in greenhouse gas emissions between 1990 and 2015 was mostly, I can't actually read what that says. Due to, a couple words are off of the, due to a 76% increase in emissions in the oil and gas sector and a 42% increase in the transportation sector. So this is just a very clear quantification of the fact that that's really where the concern is, and that's really where the focus should be. Compare that to the agricultural emissions. Now, I did these calculations myself based on the raw data, okay? So it's possible that there's some errors in here, but I don't think so. The total agricultural emissions for Canada, for agriculture, in 2005 was 8.1%, and a projection for 2030 is 8.0%. So interestingly, it's not increasing, it's actually even slightly decreasing, okay? That's all of agriculture, all of the emissions. Okay, that's the total, all right. Carbon specifically, in 1990 was, agriculture was about 1.7% of all of the emissions, and is projected to be 2.5% in 2030. So it's increasing, or it's projected to increase, and that's an important increase, but not huge, okay? And I don't know enough about the data to know why that's projected increase. I'm sure it's in the report. But in my mind, it's probably mostly due to increased mechanization and increased use of commercial fertilizers, which I'll talk about in a second. Methane, if you look at 1990, it's a pretty big piece of the total, okay? This is agricultural methane, okay? 28%, so that's important to notice. It is a big chunk of the methane in Canada. But interestingly, the projection is it's only gonna go up 1% over that long period of time, 40 years. So that's important to notice. It's not much of an increase that's expected. And I thought this was really important, so I put it in orange here. The nitrous oxide emissions in 1990 were 52% came from agriculture, and in 2030, 70%. So in other words, this right here is where the focus really should be in terms of climate work and agriculture. Okay, the nitrous oxide.
Okay, let's slow things down here a bit. Neiman mentioned nitrous oxide, methane, carbon dioxide. These are all greenhouse gases, those emissions that we're not supposed to be producing anymore that are causing climate change. Carbon dioxide is the most prevalent greenhouse gas produced by a human activity. This mainly comes from burning fossil fuels for electricity and transportation. As Neiman pointed out, agriculture produces more methane and nitrous oxide than it does carbon dioxide, and this is not a cause for celebration. The reason for that is if greenhouse gases were boxers, and I'm not talking about the type of boxers you wear underneath your pants. I'm talking about the type of boxers that get in fights, that punch you in the face. Well, I guess you could throw a pair of boxers in somebody's face. But anyways, carbon dioxide would be a featherweight if you compare it to heavyweights like methane, especially when it's compared to nitrous oxide. The reason for this is these two greenhouse gases are far more powerful. The potential to cause global warming is greater than carbon dioxide. Methane has a global warming potential 28 to 36 times higher than that of carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide packs a 265 times more powerful global warming punch than CO2.
The big picture on greenhouse gases, which I wrote an op-ed about in 2009, which was in the New York Times, called The Carnivore's Dilemma. And I kind of made this whole argument that I'm making today, but in a broader sense about kind of focusing on meat is the wrong approach. But very similar to Canada, your agricultural greenhouse gas contribution is around 8%. Ours is also, all U.S. agriculture causes about 8 to 10% of greenhouse gases. this is leaning more toward the 10% in the last couple of years because they've refigured some numbers, and this is probably closer to 10% according to current estimates. But similarly to Canada, again, in the United States, carbon and globally as well is not a major part of the problem. It's a really small piece of it. It's not really about the carbon. The carbon emissions that are due to agriculture are related to transportation, automation and harvesting, et cetera, to the machines, to the transportation, et cetera. So I do think it's good when, people are talking about how far is my food traveling, food miles, is asparagus being flown in from Chile or whatever. I think it's good to have those conversations, but this is actually not a really big piece of the puzzle. This is much more interesting. It's this nitrous oxide piece that definitely there's a lot of work that needs to be done on this. And there's a study that just came out about 2 weeks ago out of UC Davis in California, that in California, 40% of the nitrous oxide emissions of the total, so not just 40% of agriculture's emissions, but of nitrous oxide emissions, but 40% of the total nitrous oxide emissions for California are due to fertilized crops. So what struck me, going back to those numbers for Canada, well, I don't want to switch the slides because it's a little too awkward here, but you remember how we saw that number jump up at Canada for 2030 to 70%, the projection for nitrous oxide emissions? So this is probably, I don't know the figures here well enough, and I don't know how detailed the research has gotten, because this was actually really new research in California. But I would suspect that the vast majority of that 70% for Canada is also about the fertilized crops, okay? So this is part of the conversation you need to be having with your friends at church or whatever, who are talking about the methane emissions from cattle. Tell them about nitrous oxide and how this is actually a huge issue that Canadians should be thinking about. And if we're worried about diet and agriculture, we should be thinking about the amount of fertilizer that we're using on our crop production.
So does this mean cattle producers are off the hook? We can just blame everything on grain producers for producing all that nasty nitrous oxide? Not quite. Cattle do produce methane through their burping, through their manure, through, well, farting. And if you look at global emissions, agriculture does produce more greenhouse gas emissions than the transportation sector. Livestock produce about as much greenhouse gas emissions as the transportation sector itself. And in terms of livestock emissions, cattle roughly make up 65% of that.
Let's talk more specifically about methane, because really that is where the rubber meets the road on the cattle side of things. And also methane, of course, most of you I'm sure know already, is emitted from livestock lagoons. So at dairy lagoons and pig lagoons, all of the places where manure is liquefied, there's U.S. Environmental Protection Agency documentation of the fact that that was a pretty significant, dramatic increase in methane from agriculture when those began to be used widely, and there have been studies showing that. But the main methane source really is from the ruminants. It's from cattle and the other ruminants, but especially cattle. And there are two main sources. So from the manure, even if it's deposited in the fields, there's all kinds of ridiculous statements that are out there. I've heard it said a couple times on YouTube, various speakers saying, there's no manure if they're out on pasture. There's no methane if they're out on pasture. That's not true at all. So just don't ever repeat that, because that's not correct. There is methane from both sources, from ruminant animals. But let's look at it a little more specifically. First of all, I think it's important to note in conversations with people that there is research. Pennsylvania State University, which is a very, very good university, has done research, or I should say analysis, suggesting that pre-settlement ruminant emissions were greater than the existing emissions from ruminants today. So again, people have this kind of view of humans altering the environment and all these domesticated animals that we have for food. It's now causing this huge global warming problem, and this methane that's never been there before has been created. In fact, it was at existing or higher levels a long time ago. So that doesn't, answer the problem, but I think it's important to understand and to note in conversations. But there's been a lot of attention in the last couple of years to this increase in the level of methane globally. And there's a lot of debate in the scientific community about what the source of that is. And it actually is an unsettled question. However, there were two articles in the last year, one published in the journal Science and one in the journal Nature. So these are the kind of the top scientific journals that said it was cattle that were causing these methane emissions. And that's really important for everybody to understand because, again, we got to be able to answer this stuff. This is, to me, the best response. This is Dr. Robert Howarth, who's a professor at Cornell University, Ivy League university in the United States, and he's the director of the Methane Project, which is really focused on trying to figure out methane and where it's coming from. And he just gave a talk at the climate meetings for the United Nations in Bonn a few months ago, saying that there's very good evidence that this is incorrect, that the satellite data actually says, he says the conclusion that it's due to cattle is inconsistent with the satellite data. And he says fracking, not cattle, are the cause of that increase. And he has a lot of stuff to back him up. So there's at the very least some very serious doubt about whether this is true, that the global methane increase is due to cattle. Secondly, or another point on this that's really important, and I'm going to say more about this in a moment, is this question of soil bacteria. Because this really is an emerging science, there's not a lot understood about soil bacteria and how they work. But it has been known for quite a long time that these methanotrophs, or methane oxidizing bacteria, which consume methane, live in the soils. And there's really interesting research that's been going on for a long time about where they live and how they live. But the most important thing to remember is nature, again, is a system, and nothing ever works in a vacuum. Everything is connected. So in nature, this is one of the things David Montgomery does a beautiful job of explaining in The Hidden Half of Nature. Whenever something comes surfaces in nature, then everything around it evolves to adapt to it as well. So all of the microorganisms, which were the first inhabitants of the Earth, and for a long, long time, they were the only inhabitants of the Earth for a very long time, but they all evolved and adapted to every single ecosystem on the Earth. And the methanotrophs evolved a long time ago in every environment where there was methane. It is their food source. That's how they live, okay? And they still live all over the Earth wherever there's methane, okay? And so there's actually this very interesting body of research about termites, because termites are like itty-bitty little cows, okay? They have this very complex gut system. They don't have four-chambered ruminants, but exactly. I mean, they're not, you know, exactly like cows. But they're similar in that they have a symbiotic relationship with the microorganisms of their gut, which allows them to eat highly cellulosic material, in their case, wood, that pretty much nobody else can eat. And same thing with cattle, doing that with essentially grass, right? So there's this very interesting body of research looking at their biology and their ecosystem impact, and termites are actually considered to contribute about 2% of the global methane of the whole world. However, there's a lot of debate about this, because increasingly the science is showing that maybe actually termites don't contribute anything to the global methane inventory. And why is that? Well, because, I'm going to come back to this slide in just a second, but I just want to jump ahead for a moment. As this book, I researched this in a bunch of different, I've looked at a whole bunch of the scientific journals on this termite issue. But this is a textbook. I never would have imagined there's actually a textbook about the biology of termites, but there is. So this is a textbook that was written by three university professors from different universities, talking all about the complex biology of the termite and how it functions. And that book says that methane oxidation in the mounds, those are the termite mounds, and in the material and surrounding soil, the soils around the termite mounds, significantly offsets the emissions from the termites' bodies themselves. Okay, so now you see why I'm talking so much about termites, right? This is a very interesting line of research that has, again, just begun in the cattle arena. And this is something that Dr. Mark Adams at Sydney University has been doing and a few other places. People are looking at this. How much methane oxidizing bacteria exists in the soil where we have cattle? And how much of our management can impact it? Can we increase the numbers of methane oxidizing bacteria by good management? If we use high density grazing, does that increase the presence of the methane oxidizing bacteria? We don't know the answer to these questions, but I think these are really important questions that are currently being investigated. And because I think there's a growing body of evidence that the whole key to sustainability is about soil biology, I think we're going to find that the answers are well-managed soils. Uh-oh, how much time? Okay, I'm going to try to speed up. As you can see, I have a lot to say. So, well-managed soils, I think we're going to find, are offset, have more bacterial life in general. We know that there's more bacteria. We know that there is more diversity of bacteria in the well-managed grazing operations, okay? And so I think we're going to find that there's a lot more methane oxidizing bacteria inhabiting those soils in the research that's coming out. And this is going to be just the beginning, this Adams research. There's also, Kim just sent me an article last night of some work being done at University of Alberta by Dr. Bork that's already beginning to try to quantify the methanotrophic activity in the Alberta soils. Now, I noticed in the article I read, it's a short article, but it didn't talk about the different management practices and how that might impact how much oxidation is taking place. But that, to me, is the key question. Okay. Also on methane, there's a huge amount of interest and research and happening on other types of mitigation outside of the bacteria issue. Everybody kind of knows that we need, you know, the cattle industry globally needs to figure out how to deal with the methane problem and what are some of the answers to it. And the rice industry shows that this can be addressed. So the rice industry in the 1980s was the number one cause of human-generated methane emissions. And now they're actually a lot lower on the list than they used to be, and that's because there were worldwide changes to the practices. And they found that by having allowing evaporation of the water, that the flooded rice fields used to be submerged throughout the year, and they shifted it, and had their times when they were allowed to dry out. And because of that, they dramatically reduced their methane. So this is the kind of stuff that's happening in the cattle industry and should continue to happen. There's research being done on the use of seaweed as a feed amendment. There's research being done on dung beetle populations. There's even research on things like putting little metal weights in the rumens of cattle, which have been found to reduce methane emissions for some bizarre reason. Nobody really understands why. The point is, things can be done and are being examined and looked at. This is not an intractable problem. Actually, I didn't even mention it in that list, but I should have. And I talk about it in Defending Beef. Pasture management is one of the things that has been shown to reduce methane emissions by up to 25%. So just better, again, goes back to the better management issue.
Soil carbon sequestration is probably the only leg cattle have to stand on if you're going to argue cattle have a role to play in climate action. It's also something that does my head in thoroughly on a regular basis. The more I read about it, the more scientists I talk to about it, I just become more and more confused. And you know what? Fair enough. The carbon cycle is pretty complex. Soil carbon sequestration itself is an emerging science. But the idea here is through good grazing practices that focus on soil health, so things like intensive grazing, rotational grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing, they're all pretty much the same thing. Through these methods, cattle can help plants pull CO2 out of the atmosphere, then store it in the soil. How much CO2 can be stored by better grazing practices is still a matter of debate. Alan Savory, so the man who brought us holistic management, he argued in a TED Talk in 2013 that through better grazing practices, we could actually offset all emissions produced by livestock. The Food and Agricultural Organization, which is a UN body, they also argue that by adopting improved grazing practices, you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the agricultural sector. Saying that is the only leg that cattle have to stand on in terms of climate action might not be exactly fair, not quite accurate, because if you think of it, there's actually a lot of carbon stored in perennial pasture.
Globally, I think what's much more troubling in terms of what's happening to the, you know, the world agriculture and climate change is about the plow and about soils, in terms of us ruining and just causing soil erosion. Dr. David Montgomery, in his earlier book, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, again, another book I highly recommend. If any of you haven't read it, it's one of my top recommendations. The whole thesis of that book is that soil erosion outpaced soil formation, and that every sort of major fall of a civilization can be attributed in part to the fact that they didn't take good care of their soils. This is just a quick sort of not very specific showing of where the soils are degraded worldwide, and you can see it's an incredibly widespread problem. This is often attributed to livestock, so this is a really important point. This has nothing to do with livestock per se. This is about how agriculture is practiced. If you graze badly, you degrade the soils. If you graze well, you benefit the soils. It's that simple. Agriculture throughout the earth is being practiced in problematic ways, including grazing. So this is, you know, an urgent problem that needs to be addressed. But when it comes to livestock, unlike plowing, there are some really positive opportunities there. We are losing grasslands the world over, and especially this is United States specific, but in the U.S., and it's probably happening here as well, there have been subsidies for ethanol and crop production for a long time, and it's had a dramatic impact on the loss of the native prairies. Audubon Society, which is, you know, that's an environmental group focused on bird populations, now says that tall grass prairie is among the most threatened bird habitat. The Nature Conservancy and Point Blue, another environmental group in the United States, are all identifying the loss of grasslands as one of the most important environmental issues right now. And the World Wildlife Fund in 2016 said that in 2014, the Great Plains lost more acres of grasslands than the Brazilian Amazon lost to deforestation. So again, people are so worried about hamburgers and the Amazon. I debunked that whole idea in defending beef, by the way. It's actually a ridiculous claim in the first place. But what about what's happening right here in North America? We are plowing up grasslands to get subsidies and to create ethanol. 45% of the corn in the United States now is going into ethanol rather than food production. And this is not part of the daily environmental conversation and the calculation that people are making about what food choices they're going to make, and it really should be. The National Wildlife Federation this is another brand new report that just came out. It was done in conjunction with researchers at University of Wisconsin. This is from late last year. Annual release of 30 million tons of greenhouse gases are due to grasslands being cleared for farming. So these are significant problems. Okay.
I thought I'd read a little excerpt from that World Wildlife report Neiman was talking about in her presentation. It's called Plow Print if you ever get a chance to read it. One of the policy recommendations they made in the report was to integrate and incentivize improved stewardship and conservation of grassland of food and energy production. We recognize that most of the grasslands are also working land, and that well-designed grazing management systems are good for business and can also support biodiversity and ecological function in the face of changing climate and pressure to convert grasslands to cropland.
Prehistory, this is what I think we need to be thinking about. How does the earth function? And how were ecosystems created? And remembering always those microbes that have been here since the very beginning. They were the first life forms, and they were the only life forms for a very, very long time. And then what happened? Well, about 66 million years ago, we had the dinosaurs disappear. 60 million years ago, the grasses appeared. And for many millions of years, they were everywhere. Okay, grasses became very widespread about 40 million years ago, the ecosystems, and that was a dominant ecosystem the world over, maintained by huge herds of herbivores, including mostly ruminants, and including large packs of predators that kept them moving and tightly bunched. And that's how the Earth evolved. Okay, it's only in about the last 100,000 years that most of those megafauna have disappeared. Okay, and so when we think about what the Earth should look like and how it should function, this is how it evolved. It had lots of animal impact every day.
figuring out what the best food choice is in the face of climate change is a pretty challenging task, or at least I find it personally challenging as somebody who's organized on climate issues for almost a decade. But I'm also somebody who enjoys farming, and I really do enjoy working with livestock. Quite often it is cattle. With most climate solutions, I find they're pretty clear-cut, pretty straightforward. You know, you just swap out one technology for another. But with food, it's a lot more complex, which does make sense because, well, nature's pretty complex.
But this is the one I really want to highlight here. This guy here, he's a philosopher and a physicist, Fritjof Capra, a PhD, I think his PhD is actually in physics, but he's become famous for his advocacy for systems thinking. And he's the founder of something that's in Berkeley, California, called the Center for Eco-Literacy. And I actually heard him give a 5-minute talk. And it was funny because you can't say that much in 5 minutes, you think. But it sort of blew me away. Because what he said was, among other things, but this was the part I really remembered, in nature, everything is connected. Nothing is linear. Only human-created machines are linear. And I had just finished writing Defending Beef. It was actually out. It had been published. And the executive director of the Center for Eco-Literacy that was hosting this event was reading it right then. And she came up to me afterwards, and I said, wow, this talk just blew me away, even though it was only 5 minutes, because he's the founder of the organization. And she said to me, it's exactly what you're saying in Defending Beef. And I said, yes, but I'd never heard of this this person or his books or anything until that moment. And he just said so succinctly exactly what Defending Beef is saying. You can't take cattle and talk about them like they're human-made machines that operate in an A, B, C input, B, you know, A is the input, and then B is the next thing that happens, and then C is what it equals. It doesn't work like that in nature. Nothing functions like that. Everything is in systems. And so the whole problem with so much of the current discussion about this issue, in my view, is that it's really ignoring all of this, and this is what has to be done when you're talking about agriculture and cattle and climate and all of these things, because it's very complex and the interrelationships are incredible. So I want you to remember.
I hope you enjoyed the show and you have a few new talking points from Niemann's Cows and Climate Change presentation. Now, there's a few folks I need to thank before we sign off. First and most obvious, Nicolette Han Niemann. Big thank you to her for allowing us to use the audio to make this podcast. This podcast wouldn't be possible without financial support from the Alberta Real Estate Foundation, and we're very grateful for that. The podcast is part of the Rural Roots to Climate Solutions project, which is a central Alberta-based project providing opportunities for rural Albertans to learn how to benefit from climate solutions. Aside from podcasting, we also run workshops as well as field days. The project is coordinated by myself, Derek Leahy, with a lot of great support from Brenda Baird of the Stettler Adult Learning Center, and tons of great ideas from Dana Penrise, Mark Fox, and Kim Cornish. Partners in our project are Young Agrarians and Organic Alberta. I think I got about everybody. Now, if you want to send us back some feedback, let us know how we're doing, just send me an email at dleahy, so that's D-L-E-A-H-Y, at stettlerlearning.com. Happy farming wherever you are in Alberta, and remember, what's good for the farm is usually good for the climate.